What if I told you that right now the city of Los Angeles is losing like millions of dollars a year in tax revenue to subsidize mansions
Right.
and simultaneously using its legal code to trap everyday homeowners in these decaying, fire-damaged buildings?
Yeah, and legally mandating that abandoned radioactive jails literally cannot be redeveloped.
Exactly. I mean, it sounds like a dystopian novel about city planning gone wrong.
Well, it really does,
Yeah.
but it's actually just the administrative reality of how we currently manage historic preservation. The gap between the romantic idea of, saving a beautiful old building and the ground-level data of what these laws actually do is, well, it's staggering.
So welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at a topic that usually just devolves into a massive shouting match for you listening at home.
Oh, 100%.
On one side, you have preservationists arguing that we absolutely have to protect our irreplaceable architecture from developers.
Glad to save our history gap.
Yeah. And on the other side, housing advocates argue that preservation is basically just a weapon used to block desperately needed new construction. But we are throwing all that rhetoric out the window for you today.
No, I'm fully.
Instead, we're digging into a really fascinating new source, the HCM 1200 Planning Study.
Yeah, and this study is a completely different beast compared to standard urban planning literature. I mean, it's a rigorous, data-driven, parcel-by-parcel audit of all 12,295 active Los Angeles historic cultural monuments.
HCMs for short.
Right, HCMs. And the authors didn't just look at like neighborhood-wide averages. They looked at the specific dirt, the specific structures, and the specific economics of every single designated monument in the entire city.
Which is wild. So the mission for our deep dive today is to really answer the underlying question the study poses. Are these historic designations actually protecting these buildings, or is the label itself becoming counterproductive?
Right. And to answer that, the researchers built a diagnostic framework based on six distinct analytical
Well,
axes.
okay, lay them out for us.
Sure. So first is survival probability, meaning if the city removed the historic protection tomorrow, would the building just be demolished or would the owner keep it anyway?
Got it.
Second is tourist currency, like does this site actually generate public interest or foot traffic?
Okay, that makes sense.
And third is society efficiency. Is the public money going to these sites actually necessary to save them?
Let me guess, the next three deal more with the surrounding area.
They do, yeah. The fourth axis is externality load. Basically, does the monument actively harm the neighborhood? Say, by being a magnet for blight or carrying environmental toxicity.
Wow, okay.
Fifth is neighborhood health, which looks at the socioeconomic equity of the surrounding area. And finally, alternative use value.
Meaning the opportunity cost of the land.
Exactly. Like, could this parcel be doing something much more valuable for the city if the monument just wasn't there?
You know, this sounds less like a typical urban planning review and more like an emergency room triage system.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. It's like they're giving every single monument in the city a full physical and financial health checkup, prioritizing who actually needs a doctor, rather than just assuming everyone in the waiting room is doing perfectly fine just because they have a fancy bronze plaque on their door.
That triage analogy is spot on. The whole objective is to assign a functional verdict to each property, to pull back the curtain on what the designation is functionally doing in the real world.
Well, let's start with that third axis you mentioned, subsidy efficiency, because if we are doing a triage checkup, the most common treatment prescribed by the city is cash.
Right, money.
Specifically in California, we're talking about Mills Act tax contracts. Now, for those listening who aren't super in the weeds of property tax law, how does the subsidy actually work?
So the Mills Act is essentially a contract between a property owner and the city. The city agrees to drastically reassess the property's value, which often reduces the owner's property tax bill by like 50% or even more.
That's huge.
It is. But in exchange, the owner is legally bound to take all those tax savings and plow them directly back into restoring and maintaining the historic character of the building.
Okay, so that makes perfect sense on paper. You give a tax break, you get a beautifully restored piece of history in return. But the HCM 1200 study looked at the actual flow of this money. What did the triage checkup actually reveal?
Well, the numbers are incredibly skewed. Out of the 12,295 monuments across Los Angeles, only 8%, just 99 sites, classify as genuinely load-bearing.
Wait, only 8%. And load-bearing meaning the tax break is basically the only thing keeping the roof from caving in.
In financial terms, yeah. The study cross-referenced the Active Mills Act contracts with neighborhood equity tiers.
Okay.
And these tiers are calculated using composite metrics, things like median income, historical redlining data, access to capital, you know, and those 99 load-bearing sites sit in medium to high or high barrier neighborhoods.
So areas where people might not have a ton of extra cash laying around.
Exactly. The owners there likely do not have the liquid capital to just hire specialized historic restoration architects or source expensive period accurate materials.
Right.
So the public subsidy there is doing real necessary work. If the city pulled the funds, the preservation effort would just collapse.
Okay, so that is the system functioning properly, but 8% is a tiny fraction of the whole. Where is the rest of the money going?
Well, that brings us to the contrasting statistic, which is kind of the aha moment of the study.
Wait on us.
17% of all monuments, that's 221 sites, hold active Mills Act subsidies. But they're located in low-barrier, highly resourced neighborhoods.
Mm.
We're talking about the absolute wealthiest zip codes in the city.
Are you kidding? So the city is subsidizing the preservation of mansions for people who can already afford mansions.
Essentially, yes. The study labels this the subsidies for the already saved paddock.
Subsidies for the already saved. Wow.
Yeah. The data suggests that in these high resource areas, the property owners already have the private wealth and the neighborhood property values to justify maintaining these structures at a premium standard.
Without the city's help.
Completely independent of public assistance.
Yeah.
So the preservation outcome was practically guaranteed anyway. The subsidy isn't load-bearing. It's totally redundant.
So let's talk about the scale of that redundancy for a second. When you slash property taxes for mansions and wealthy zip codes, there's a very real cost to the public.
Oh, it's a massive opportunity cost.
Okay.
Across all the monuments carrying these contracts, Los Angeles is losing roughly $20 million in annual property tax revenue.
$20 million.
Yeah. And because property taxes fund broad municipal services, that is money pulled directly from the Los Angeles Unified School District, from county health services, infrastructure.
Oh, man.
And the data shows that about 82.6% of those tax savings flow directly into those wealthier, low-barrier areas.
It's like the city handing out an exclusive coupon for groceries. But then you realize 80% of the coupons are going to people who are already in the checkout line at a premium organic supermarket.
Right.
They were completely ready to pay full price. The outcome didn't change, but the public treasury is just empty.
Exactly. And that depletion of public funds really forces us to look at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
What happens to the monuments that actually have a low survival probability and don't have wealthy owners to bail them out?
Right, because if you're a middle-class owner of a historic property and a disaster hits, you can't just tap into a trust fund.
Right. And this introduces a phenomenon the study calls the trapped residential monument.
Trapped.
Yeah. This is where the strict rules of preservation, which, again, are meant to be protective, actually become destructive.
Wait, destructive how? I thought the whole point of a historic designation was to prevent a building from rotting or being destroyed.
To understand this, you really have to look at the mechanics of the red tape. When a building is designated, it is bound by the Secretary of the Interior standards for rehabilitation.
Okay.
And those are enforced by local cultural heritage commissions. So you can't just run to a big box hardware store and buy standard drywall and modern vinyl windows to fix a damaged home.
You can't.
No. You often have to source custom milled old growth wood, hire specialized artisans for lath and plaster work, or custom order period accurate glass fenestration.
Oh, wow. So the cost of repairs isn't just high. It's exponentially higher than a normal home renovation.
It is astronomical.
Yeah.
Now imagine a private residence in an average neighborhood that suffers severe fire damage. Or maybe it's sitting in a liquefaction zone where the foundation has cracked.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
The owner is trapped. They are legally barred from demolishing the structure. They're barred from doing cheap, modern alterations to make it habitable. And they simply cannot afford the specialized historic restoration that the law requires.
Wait, so if they can't fix it and they can't tear it down, they just, what, leave it? Can't they sell it to someone who wants a historic restoration project?
They try, but the market dictates the outcome. No developer wants to buy a property where the restoration costs actually exceed the final market value of the home.
Ah, right. The math doesn't work.
Exactly. And the study gives a really harrowing example of this paralysis, the Burnside Cluster.
What's that?
These are three apartment buildings on Burnside Avenue, HCM 423, 424, and 425. They were designated back in 1989. And the researchers used a method called human in the loop. Or HITL verification.
Which means what exactly? They didn't just trust a spreadsheet.
Correct. They had human researchers manually review recent high-resolution Google Street View imagery and cross-reference it with local business and property listings.
Quote.
And they verified that these historically protected apartments are currently listed as permanently closed. They're boarded up, decaying, and totally empty.
Unbelievable. I mean, this completely flips the narrative of preservation on its head. You're saying the very law meant to save the building from the wrecking ball is the exact mechanism guaranteeing that it stays a boarded up eyesore because no one wants to pay a trap.
Yes. It is a legal paralysis. And, you know, while a boarded up residential fourplex is a tragedy for the neighborhood, the externality load, to use our fourth axis, scales up into a massive public danger when we move from residential buildings to obsolete civic and industrial sites.
Oh, so you're talking about the big stuff, like factories, infrastructure.
Yeah. The study categorizes these as blocking redevelopment cases. These are sites like old manufacturing plants, retired county jails, abandoned rail tunnels.
Okay, and why are these a bigger problem?
Because they score incredibly high on the alternative use value axis. They often sit on massive parcels of land right in the urban core, usually adjacent to major transit lines where the city desperately needs to build dense housing.
Well, so what's stopping a developer from buying an old jail, keeping the cool Art Deco facade, and just building a high-rise apartment complex behind it?
Honestly, the sheer physics and chemistry of the land.
Really?
Yeah. The study cross-referenced these monuments with environmental and geological databases. Take HEM 587, the Lincoln Heights Jail. It's this massive vacant structure in a transit-rich area, but spatial data reveals it sits squarely in a liquefaction zone.
Let's clarify that term for a second for the listeners. Liquefaction means that during a major earthquake, the soil basically loses its stiffness and behaves like a liquid, right? Like buildings just sink or tear themselves apart.
Precisely. Retrofitting a massive, heavy, unreinforced historic structure to survive liquefaction is technically complex and just wildly expensive.
Right.
But the Lincoln Heights Jail also has a massive externality load. The researchers pulled data from the Department of Toxic Substances Control.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. There are four known EnviroStir cleanup sites within 500 meters of the jail.
Oh.
And another site, the Belmont Tunnel, HTM 790, has five cleanup sites nearby.
Wow. So trying to redevelop the Lincoln Heights Jail is like inheriting a classic vintage car, but you're legally not allowed to change the body. And oh, by the way, the engine is leaking radioactive waste.
Exactly.
No wonder developers won't touch it. I mean, the math is completely broken.
It's an impossible equation. The historic designation blocks any higher value use of the land, but because the environmental cleanup and seismic retrofitting are so cost prohibitive, the structure itself is never actually restored. It just sits there, leaching whatever is in the soil, completely frozen by the designation.
That is just wild. But, you know, the methodology here is really impressive, layering tax data, seismic maps, toxicity reports over these parcels.
Very thorough.
But something you mentioned earlier really caught my ear, the human-in-the-loop verification on Google Street View.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine paying researchers to manually scour street-level photos of 1,295 properties is incredibly tedious. How did they find all the hidden distress across the city? Because it's not like there's a public database of houses with sagging roofs.
Right, there isn't. And they realized that relying on formal code complaints or 311 calls creates a massive bias.
Oh, sure. Wealthy neighborhoods complain to the city constantly, but struggling neighborhoods might avoid calling inspectors for fear of fines or eviction.
Exactly. So to get around that, the researchers actually deployed an AI, specifically Claude Vision, to act as a digital building inspector.
Come on. I am extremely skeptical. How does an AI looking at a 2D photograph from a Google Maps car know if a building is structurally failing?
Well, it's all about pixel analysis and geometric distortion.
Yeah.
The researchers fed the Street View images into Claude Vision with very specific prompts. They didn't just ask, hey, does this look bad?
Right.
They asked the AI to scan for deviations from standard right angles, which indicates foundation settling or roof sagging.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah. They asked it to detect color anomalies associated with fire charring or those blue tarpaulins people put on leaky roofs. They even programmed it to measure vegetation, specifically looking for overgrowth that covered more than 30% of primary entryways or windows.
Because that's a key indicator of abandonment.
Exactly.
Okay, that is actually fascinating. It's breaking down the subjective concept of blight into quantifiable visual metrics. But did it actually work?
It did. They ran the AI over 342 properties that had absolutely zero formal code complaints on file with the city. So on paper, these monuments were pristine.
And what did they find?
The AI flagged 15 actively distressed properties the city was completely blind to. For instance, the Wilbur F. Woodhouse, HCM 557, the AI detected fire damage, severe structural sagging, and massive vegetation overgrowth.
Wow.
Another property, the Charles B. Booth residence, was flagged for a tarped roof and structural neglect.
That is basically a superpower for a city planning department, uncovering invisible decay without leaving the office. What did that kind of computational power actually cost the researchers?
The total computing cost for both sweeps they ran was $16.18.
Wait, $16 total?
Total, less than 20 bucks.
That is absurd. $16 to replicate what would take a fleet of human city inspectors weeks of driving around in municipal vehicles to accomplish. That completely changes the economics of how a city can monitor its own regulations.
It really does. But, you know, before we declare AI the savior of urban planning, we really need to talk about the study's biggest limitation. And honestly, this limitation is the most intellectually honest part of the entire paper.
Oh, I love when researchers admit what they don't know. With all this high-tech analysis, did they solve every monument's mystery? Or what couldn't the $16 AI and the toxic soil maps figure out?
Well, out of the 12,295 monuments, the study explicitly labeled 53% of them, 692 properties, as having insufficient data.
Wait, over half the monuments in the city, they couldn't determine if the designation was helping or hurting.
They couldn't. The public open data signals were just too weak. And they refuse to guess. The primary reason for this massive blind spot is what they call the vacancy proxy problem.
Okay, walk me through that. What exactly is a vacancy proxy?
Well, the city of Los Angeles doesn't have a centralized real-time database that tracks whether a building actually has human beings living or working inside it.
Which makes sense, privacy-wise.
Right. So to guess if a building is active, the city relies on a proxy metric, which is building permits.
I'm trying to think through the logic of that. So the assumption is if someone recently filed a permit to do electrical work or remodeling, the building must be actively used.
Yes. The study's methodology mirrored the city's logic. If there was recent investment over $250,000 or a major permit pulled, the property was flagged as active.
Okay.
But if there were zero permits and a cluster of code complaints, it was flagged as vacant.
But wait. That doesn't measure occupancy at all. That measures construction activity.
You've hit the nail on the head.
I mean, think about it. If I'm a family living in a beautifully maintained historic craftsman home and I've happily lived there for a decade, I might not have needed to pull a major construction permit in 10 years.
Right.
My home is fully occupied, but to the city's database, my status is a giant question mark.
Exactly.
And on the flip side, if a developer buys an abandoned, rotting building and pulls a permit just to clear out asbestos to prepare for a future demolition, the database logs that decaying, empty building as active, that is a huge gap.
It's a massive gap, and the authors point out this exact flaw. The proxy measures paperwork, not human presence. They acknowledge that without real occupancy data, like, say, analyzing Department of Water and Power usage rates, or tracking the percentage of mail marked undeliverable by the post office, any conclusion they make about those 692 properties would essentially be a fabrication.
Wow.
Yeah, and this prevents them from making a sweeping, binary, we should preserve everything or demolish everything conclusion.
You know, it is really refreshing to read a study that says, here is the limit of our knowledge, rather than forcing the data to fit a specific narrative.
Absolutely.
So as we pull back to look at the whole picture for you listening today, why should you care about a parcel level audit of Los Angeles monuments, even if you don't live in a historic home or even in LA?
It matters. Because how a city manages its dirt dictates everything else. It dictates housing availability, which drives rent prices. It dictates the economic vitality of commercial corridors and neighborhood safety.
Exactly.
When preservation laws lack nuance, when they treat a toxic, seismically dangerous abandoned jail with the exact same legal rigidity as a perfectly maintained Victorian home, they freeze the city.
Right.
They lock up valuable land near transit. They trap lower-income homeowners in decaying structures. And they bleed public funds through inefficient tax subsidies.
The lesson here isn't delist everything or that historic preservation is bad. Yeah. We all want to live in cities that have character and physical links to their past. The lesson is that the policy has to adapt to the physical reality of the building.
Yeah. Adaptive reuse is the clear path forward here. For those toxic blocking redevelopment sites, the rigid ideology just has to give way to practicality. Keep the historic stone facade to maintain the neighborhood's visual character, but legally allow developers to gut the contaminated interior and build modern, seismically safe workforce housing inside.
Manage the city like a living, breathing organism, not a sealed museum.
Beautifully said.
And that brings us to a final provocative thought for you to take away from this deep dive. We've spent this time talking about physical buildings that are trapped by their environment. Homes sinking into liquefaction zones, civic centers sitting on contaminated soil, materials naturally wearing away over a century.
Right.
The traditional mindset is that we must save the physical bricks at all costs. But if these physical structures are increasingly trapped by environmental hazards and the unstoppable wear of time, what if the future of historic preservation isn't about saving the physical building at all?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
If a structure becomes too dangerous to occupy but too culturally significant to alter, might we one day preserve our cities entirely through digital twins and virtual reality, letting the physical bricks return to the earth so new life can be built over them while we visit the past in the cloud? Something to think about.